A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I thought that I would outgrow this shit, you know? So it's a sense of I'm immature.
Yeah.
You know, why didn't I grow up?
Yeah.
What happened?
Yes. Sir. What if the writer is attempting to create a story where nothing much happens, where people don't change? More reflection of the real world.
Nothing happens in the world? Are you out of your fucking mind?
Welcome to A Theory of Mind, a podcast about brains, minds, and the lived-in experience of change. I'm your host, author and biographer Ben McKelvey, and this week I'm really excited to sit down with one of my oldest friends, Cameron Knight, who has for a couple of decades now been a professional comedian. You may know him from his old Comedy Channel show, Stand Up Australia, or Unreal Estate that he did for Channel 9, or you may know him from one of his excellent stand-up shows. But today we don't really talk about comedy or television. Instead, we talk about Cam's journey with addiction and adult ADHD, which is something that he's only relatively recently been diagnosed for. I love getting the opportunity to talk to a friend today about things that we'd not really spoken about before, and I hope you get something out of this conversation also. Just a quick note, we do mention suicide on the show today, but we do just sort of skip over it, so be duly warned. Anyway, if you want to keep up with the show, hit me up on Instagram at Benny Mck, BennyMck, or on Facebook, which is Ben McKelvey Writer. And here's Cam Knight.
Explore. One of them is a 10-day compassionate silence retreat.
You could probably get sponsorship.
Well, that's
a
bit of shit.
Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see.
Anyway, back to my podcast.
Yeah, your podcast. Here we go.
I thought a really good place to start might be at school, because I can imagine that you and I had pretty similar experiences in school, but then we, you know, our energy changed when we were adults or something like that. But can you just tell me, I'll tell you just quickly what my thoughts were. My thoughts were there was something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. You know, that's that was sort of like had a shame around that, you know, and like I was...
Yeah.
I was a student that did really well until I didn't do really well. And then when I started doing really well, I literally just could not study. You know, I just couldn't take on the information. I was naughty all the time, you know, like I was just bouncing off the walls. I just couldn't do it. And that was shameful to me.
Yep.
What was your experience?
Similar. I'm not sure. Did you ever get diagnosed for anything, or did anyone look at you?
No, it was like the 80s.
Well, that's what I was about to say. So it's... You know, I was born in the 70s, late 70s, and so I was in school in the 80s, and so there's a lot more acceptance around these sorts of things these days, and whereas back then it was very black and white. You're either a good or a bad kid, you know, and I think at the core of it, like I know my parents see this, and I know teachers that sort of took the time to get to know me knew that I was a good kid, but I was a bit of a daydreamer. There were certain things that I would really get focused at, and then a lot of things that I would find very confusing. A lot of the times when I look back on my childhood or throughout school, it feels very cloudy.
Yeah.
It's hard to sort of explain, but that is kind of
accurate
description
of
memory.
Like you're stuck in that moment. You're like, this is going to take forever. Nothing's ever going to pass. I'm not going to take on any of this information. Nothing's ever going to get any better. It's just I'm stuck.
Yeah, like your whole life, it's like, you know, when you're out at a party or you're out and having a great night and the night goes like that and it's gone.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with childhood, you know. You'd be playing and having a really good time and lunchtime just seems to go in a second, but then the hours drag within those rooms or your clock watching until the school day ends. But yeah, there were certainly from a very young age, I think there were problems or cracks sort of starting appearing within what I was good at and what I was bad at, I guess. And there were some teachers, like I said, that were more accepting of that and others that weren't. But by the time I think I got to about grade four, I had a really rough teacher that was really quite nasty to me and talked down to me a lot and belittled me a lot in front of the class. And even my parents did actually go and have a chat with her.
Mm.
And then she turned on me even more in the class and spoke about that. Oh, you dobbed it on me to your parents and made it even worse.
You're a 9-year-old
carrying this around. Yeah, grade four. And so then by Year seven, by year seven, I was on a behavioural program, which was...
Had somebody diagnosed you with something?
No,
or?
No. So my parents at that stage had gone, they'd taken me to see a doctor. I was speaking to my mum about this morning because she was asking me what I was doing today, and I told her I was coming to see you and talk about this, and so we had a little bit of a chat, and she said, you know, we did try, we just didn't really know, there's not much information about that sort of thing. We took you to a doctor. The first doctor that we took you to said that he thought you had worms. Which is, that's, so then I went on worm treatment.
At what age did he think
you
had worms?
I can't remember. Well, I think it was around like 8 or 10 years old or something like that. They took me in to see this doctor and so he thought I had worms.
Brain worms? Like
brain. Yeah, they'd come up from my bum.
How do worms and got up.
I have no idea. Well, maybe because I couldn't sit still. I was fidgeting all the time. My legs were moving. I couldn't stay still in the chair. I was always getting up. I was walking around. Oh, he's got
worms. That's a problem with his bum.
His bum's itchy. He wants to wipe it on the floor like a dog, you know? So maybe put him on a treatment of Combantrin and move on with your lives. And obviously that didn't work. Then they, my parents drew a really hard line and I wasn't allowed any lollies. Yeah. I particularly wasn't allowed red cordial for some reason. That was the bad colour additive.
That was such an 80s thing. Isn't it? Like, oh, that kid's had too much red cordial.
Yeah, he's had too much red cordial. Yeah. So I wasn't allowed red cordial. I wasn't allowed, allowed red snakes. I wasn't allowed Panadol from back then as well because the Panadol had a dye additive in it that apparently affected mood and in children. So not that I was taking it very often, but they made sure to steer me clear of that. And I most certainly wasn't allowed to have Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
And they did test this. I do remember as a kid being at some parties and begging them to have some Coca-Cola or begging them to have something form of sugar. And sure enough, I would go off the rails.
Yeah, it was.
It was me running around going crazy.
There was something in that.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely affected my personality. I wasn't listening. I was absolutely climbing the walls. At one stage, once I, Mum said that I was climbing underneath the table at a dinner party, biting everybody's ankles. Mm. I don't know if that had anything to do with ADHD or a fetish, but here we are. So,
what were the conversations like that you had with your parents when you were a kid? Because I remember distinctly, you know, them just being exasperated with me and just going, I don't understand your behavior. And I was like, I don't get it either.
Yeah.
But did you, were the conversations that you had with your dad just about frustration or were they also sort of about maybe there's something going on here?
I don't think I really had a conversation with dad about it. Like my dad, I know they were frustrated. I know it was frustrating. I know it was tricky and they didn't really know what to do. You know, they did take me to hypnotist as well to sort of see if I could learn any forms of self-soothing, which apparently didn't stick. They did that a couple of times. There was one other time later on, and I remember that time when I was about 13 or 14 and was having real difficulty at school. I went to see a hypnotist and he told me, he taught me some basic lessons of, you know, breathing and self-soothing and told me to choose a form of music that I could listen to whenever I was feeling anxious and uptight.
Tool.
Highly strung, Tool. it was Oxygen by Jean-Michel Jarre, right. Which is what I listened to because that was one of my favourite vinyls that my dad had. So I would try and listen to that. I would try these things and then, you know, it just didn't really stick.
Yeah.
And also, you don't have these sorts of conversations, what is wrong with me, with your kid or with even with your parents back then.
Yeah.
You, like you said, you carry a lot of shame around with it because you think I'm bad. There's something wrong. I don't know what that is, but it's bad. And my dad was a pharmacist and so sometimes he would say things like, you know, there might be just a chemical imbalance in your brain and, you know, we might have to work on that. But my dad, again, never wanted to medicate me. He never wanted to put me on anything. There were times that dad had conversations with teachers where they were really concerned about me and my behaviour in school. And bless him, like he was in my corner. He said, there's nothing wrong with my son.
Mm.
He's intelligent. You're just not teaching him correctly.
Mm.
Learn to reach his intelligence, which is a really lovely thing to say, but I don't know if I was that intelligent. I just think they just didn't have the teaching mechanisms for...
Well, it's also not how systems work.
Exactly.
Especially not governmental systems.
Totally, and yeah.
Like I really sympathise with you talking about about your dad, it's just not the conversation that you had, you know, just about the, you know, your neural makeup and things like that. It's like, you know, you're not going to have a conversation with a policeman about the failures of capitalism or why crime happens.
Yeah.
You know, it's
just,
you know, that's sort of the relationship that people have with your dad. But I wouldn't mind actually skipping ahead, because quite often what happens with people who have ADHD or issues related to ADHD, it sort of gets ironed out, or it doesn't get ironed out, and then it just becomes part of their adult life.
Yeah.
And it doesn't become addressed.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's much easier for you when you're an adult to mold your life around your circumstance. When you're a kid, you sort of have this one-size-fits-all experience. And so if you have ADHD, you're going to have the same experience as somebody who doesn't. But when you're an adult, you can actually build a life for yourself that's going to work the way it works for you.
Yeah.
But you found later on in life that being diagnosed was positive for you, actually recognizing that there was something going on. That it happened relatively recently, but it did happen for you. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it happened a couple of years ago. It was off the back of me getting sober. So I've been sober now for 4 years. And I thought that with me stopping drinking, a lot of things would change. I would become one of those people that posts photographs of themselves during Dry July or October, and I feel great and I'm blessed and all that sort of crap. And it wasn't the case. I found that I felt more lost and more depressed in that first year, definitely about 6 months in, that than I'd ever been. I felt really burnt out.
Can we go back just quickly about the time and the reason why you decided to, you know, sort of clean up? You don't have to go into any specifics or anything like that.
Yeah.
But you weren't a big drug user, but drinking was the thing that was a bit of a problem for you at the time?
I think at that time I had been drinking quite a lot, and I think that's just because it goes hand in hand with my career as a comedian. You're paid in beer for the first few years, and that's your relationship. It's like a reward thing. You drink to celebrate and you drink to commiserate the good and the bad gigs. So it had definitely got to a stage where I was drinking every day. I think more so in my early 20s, I was taking a fair amount of drugs. And
what were the things that you were doing when you decided to clean up? You're like, this is the problem part.
It wasn't my choice. It was asked of me by my wife.
Yeah.
And
okay. But you obviously thought it was a good enough idea.
I had definitely felt, I had started feeling the effects. I had started seeing that I was really tired and not present, and was watching, again, like a child in a schoolroom, watching the clock until it ticked over to 5 o'clock so I could have a beer or a glass of wine, because as a parent then, we were new parents, you know, you deserve it. You just did a full day with your child and, you know, they're still alive, pat yourself on the back and here we go again, you know. It's that sort of thing. And then when I was on the road, I would drink and party and have a good time and celebrate the fact that I was out of the house, I guess. And,
do you think
it was really wearing me down?
Yeah, you're sort of, you know, giving yourself excuses for drinking. You're kind of like, oh, this is why I'm drinking now, and this is why I'm drinking now. And then you kind of look back and you go, oh, I'm giving myself 10 excuses in the last 11 days to drink.
That's right. Yeah. But there's a joke that I said that, you know, that I said to Belle, that my partner, she said, I think you've got a problem with drinking. And I said, no, I think I'm pretty bloody good at it, you know. And
she's like, oh, okay, keep drinking then, good joke.
Everything's a show, isn't it? So when she kind of asked me to stop, the idea was that I was only going to do a year.
Yeah.
It was just, we'll just take a year off and reset, you know.
Did you try and do it yourself before you tried to get help?
Yeah. So I pretty much white-knuckled it for the first 12 months. And so it was about halfway through that first year that I was really, really, really burnt out. And
did you have
exhausted.
Support from people who were going on the same journey
as
you?
I had a couple of people who were in a program and were sort of asking me to do it, and I was very reticent to join. And because at that stage, I think, again, I was bound to the idea of shame being attached to that as well. Like I didn't want to say that I was an alcoholic out loud, you know.
It's a big difference from stopping drinking to identifying that you're an alcoholic.
Yeah. And again, also I thought, well, I'm only going to do this for a year, so why would I go to a meeting? Because I don't have a problem, I'll be fine, you know. But I did go to a GP, and I sat down and just told her what was going on for me and how I was feeling, and she just said, you know, you might be depressed. You know, have you ever had antidepressants? And I said, no, I really didn't want to take antidepressants.
Why did you go to the GP?
Because I didn't know what was going on with me. I felt so flat, so worn out. It had started becoming, it had started sort of manifesting itself in my body. Like I would wake up in the morning just with really excruciating lower back pain, and I just thought, well, I feel like I'm falling apart.
Which you thought perhaps there was something physiological happening?
Yeah, and I was like, what is happening to me? Is this all in my mind? Am I creating this, or is there something wrong? I should be feeling great.
Yeah.
I haven't been drinking. I feel like I'm eating well.
Yep.
Why aren't I feeling great like everybody else does when they stop drinking? And so I wanted to go and sort this out, you know. And so then she put me on a script for antidepressants, and I just sort of held off for a bit, and I spoke to Dad about it.
Were you reluctant?
Massively.
Why did she give them to you then?
Well, because that's what they do, I feel like. Yeah, right. You know, it seems to be their go-to. Oh, you're sad. Take this.
Yeah, yeah.
And
did she try and talk you into it a little bit, or
not particularly? I mean, sort
just
of.
Like, here's the script.
She wasn't like hard lining it. Yeah, just yeah. Go, you must take this; it'll make you better. But have you thought about giving this a go? And I'll write you a script anyway. And you know, it's up to you if you want to. But yeah. It's there, and you know, it wasn't that intense. But I speak to my dad about it. And again, like I was very reluctant as well, just because we have in our family like a history of on my mother's side, my grandma. Ended up in a bit of a pickle. She ended up in a psych ward when she was late in her life, and then my cousin as well in his early 20s was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and he ended up unfortunately taking his life. And so I was quite scared. I was thinking, oh man, maybe I'm next here. Maybe this is just genetic, and I can't outrun this, you know. And I was.
Did you talk to your GP about that?
Yeah, I did, and I spoke to Dad about it too. And I was nervous about just the side effects of these things as well, because they can have the adverse effect.
Yeah,
like they can actually cause even more of a problem. Mm. And so, I took them and I spoke to Dad, and he just said, "Look, if you want to try this out, you're going to have to try it for a year to get the full." Experience to actually see
to get
that
the effect.
It's starting to work. And I thought, okay, well, I'll give that a year then. All right. So, and it made me feel so detached and even kind of worse. I started sort of shrinking into myself a little bit. And I don't know how I managed to still do comedy or go out. I felt sometimes as if I was operating from a different area. It's like playing a computer game.
Yeah.
Like I was sort of outside of myself a little bit. But just sort of everything was just numbed. And I didn't cry that entire year.
Yeah, right.
And tried to.
Would you find yourself like watching movies and listening to music and something like that and go, fuck, I should feel more?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I started to really miss that and resent that. And then by the end of it, it got to a point for me where I did start having those side effects that you see on the box.
Mm.
It did start affecting me in a way that was really quite scary, and it would come about in just I'd be doing the most menial of tasks or just be thinking about something that I had to do, like, oh, I've got to pay a bunch of bills or I've got to get my tax done, and I'd hear the voice, why don't you kill yourself? Why don't you
really?
And
you'd never heard that voice previously?
No. And that started really scaring me, and if I was thinking about anything, if I was trying to reflect in any way, or maybe a thing that I'd done wrong, or
you like kill yourself.
Kill yourself.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, who's saying that? And it would really scare me. It would come at me in different ways. And I just, that started happening on a daily basis, that I was kind of, well, when am I going to tell myself to kill myself? This is awful.
Yeah, right. So you'd be waiting to be surprised by this voice in whatever it is that you were doing. You know, you'd be like, oh, one of the kids is crying, kill yourself.
Oh, kill yourself. Fuck. Yeah, your shit dad, kill yourself.
What, did you immediately take yourself off these antidepressants?
Well, that's the thing. You've got to wean yourself off them. And then so I had to – I spoke to Mum and Dad about it, and I said, oh, this stuff is freaking me out. I don't like the way this is going. Again, given
– Your dad's like, well, why don't you kill yourself?
Why don't you kill yourself? And, well, just given our history as well, and this is the thing, I wasn't going to do that to myself, But I also just didn't want to hear this voice in my head telling me to do that thing. Like, I know that it wouldn't have led me to doing that.
I know negativity. It's this extreme negativity.
Yeah, but it was just this. I was like, I don't want to hear it. I just don't want to hear this anymore. It's really awful. So I went and said to, again, to the same GP, explained exactly what I pretty much just said to you, and said, I want to get off this stuff. I don't like this stuff. Yeah. And she said, maybe you need to go and see a psychiatrist and have a proper conversation with them. And I just thought, why didn't we do that a year ago?
That's exactly what I was thinking when I heard that she had given you the script.
Yeah. So I went and saw this psychiatrist. And again, so I had to go through this whole process and explain my childhood and what that was like. And, you know, because I did have a really tough time at school to the point that, I mean, I got booted out of high school, got expelled from a boarding school and then had to go back. And so I was always carrying around that guilt and the shame of that. Mm. But also I think I just want to go back on that childhood bit. You get told so many times that you're bad that you just throw your hands up in the air and just go, I am fine. I will be bad. How am I going to prove to you that I'm not anymore? Because you've already made that decision about me. Fuck it. I want to be bad.
Man, I had that 2 days ago.
No, I robbed a bank.
No. Yeah. What had happened was a friend of mine in Perth, he had bumped into a kid that had known me when I was very young.
Yeah.
You know, like when I was 6 or 7. And this guy said, oh, yeah, we know Ben. We both know Ben. Oh, yeah, cool. And it's like, oh, what was he like when he was a little kid? He goes, oh, man, he was such a naughty little kid.
Yeah.
I must have been 9 or 10 because, you know, that's when I sort of had behavioral issues.
Yeah.
And as soon as he told me that, I was angry and I felt the shame and I was like intellectually I'm like, who gives a shit what this 9-year-old kid was like? I'm a man. I've got this whole set of experiences and I'm a completely different person.
Yeah.
And I was like, I was back in that place. I was like, well, fuck him. You know, like fuck him, fuck everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I mean, I grew up in a town of less than 1,000 people. So everybody knew that.
Yeah.
It's not like it's here in a big city where you can just be anybody you want to be and only your close circle of friends and your family kind of know you or see any sense of change.
Mm.
I ran from that town at 17. So I know they still remember me as that kid. And I know that I've still seen, oh, man, you were a handful, man. You got so much mischief. Or, oh, I bet you got your bloody hands full with your kids now knowing they're yours. You know, it's that they are your kids, aren't they, after it's all? You hear all of that and you're just like, thanks, man. Yeah. Like, maybe give me a fucking break here.
You kind of feel like you've taken charge of your life and you've done something different and you've, you know, perhaps broken out of your circumstances and things like that.
Yeah.
And there are situations in which you can just be put straight back there.
Yeah. And you can do so much work on yourself, mindfulness and acceptance all this sort of, and that anyone can say just one little thing, I think, particularly about your childhood. And you're straight back into that. You're that little kid in the corner like, oh, man, I hate myself so much.
So did you recognize, though, with this psychiatrist that you're kind of like, oh, it's this big ball of string that I'm just going to have to sort of pull out and take the threads out and all of this stuff that had happened to me when I was a kid.
I just sort of explained a bunch of stuff to him, and I know I think what he really latched onto was my impulsive behavior, my irrational thoughts, and I also had a lot of frustrations and irritability, and I had the ability to explode.
Yeah.
A lot of anger.
Did you recognize that in the things that he'd said about you and went, oh, yeah, you kind of get it?
Yeah, well, he just went, these things sound like symptoms of ADHD and it's not depression, because we talked about what I was like in school and how I have handled things as an adolescent, how I've handled things in my early 20s and 30s, all of those sorts of things, because mine was a thing where I would just bottle it up, and then it would just explode.
Yeah.
I'd feel great and nobody else around me would. Yeah. They would just be like, what is going on with that guy? Yeah. You know, just Mount Etna walking around. And so he just said, these sound like symptoms of ADHD. And then I did like a checklist test with him and just smashed that.
did passed really well. the adult ADHD test with flying colours.
Yep, got A plus.
Yeah, well done.
A plus ADHD. And he was really great, actually. He's a really good guy. I mean, I still have to check in with him.
So what do you do with you? You were being medicated for the wrong...
I was... Yeah, I was... I was
So did you discontinue it straight away?
No. So then I had to wean myself off the
antidepressants
over a course of a few months whilst also taking the Ritalin. And so then slowly that sort of balanced out, and then I was just on the Ritalin then.
What was the period like when you were taking Ritalin and...
Oh, it's a bit weird. For the first 3 or 4 days, like all I wanted to do was sleep.
Yeah.
And it was really hard to explain that to your partner when you've got a couple of kids.
Yeah.
You're just like, I can't get out of bed. This is knocking me out. Like, I have to go back to sleep. It's like so weird that I had to do that and just lay... It would just come on, just this, I'm exhausted. I need to go and lie down. I'm really sorry, you know. And then that sort of balanced out. And then once I was on the Ritalin alone, again, we had to sort of play around with it. You just become a bit of a guinea pig.
Yeah.
There's no rhyme or reason. This is what you need.
Yep.
It's all suited individually, really. So we had to work out how much.
And they can't, you know, it's not like they can give you a blood test and go, okay, this is working well. It's like, how do you feel?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have to assess that against your circumstances. You're like, yeah, I don't feel good, but this happened yesterday and this happened last week.
Yeah,
and then you're like, well, maybe those things only happen because the medication is not what I should be having right now. And that's tough.
I did notice a marked change in my personality very, very early on when I was just on the Ritalin. There was a couple of times when I sort of overdid it and was a bit like, I'm going to clean the house, you know.
Well, settle down. Do not clean the house.
You know, says, I'm going to get my life in order. Let's do this. Write that manual. That
script. But what were the good things that you saw?
I just a sense of calm. And it's still sort of there. Like I can, I can start a project and sort of sit on something and not go flit around and do multiple things during the day. And do very little of a lot of things, which was really frustrating to me, and it was very frustrating to my partner, and I think also again very frustrating to school teachers when it's just like you're meant to do one thing.
But it's frustrating for yourself as well. Like it's difficult when you can't finish things.
Absolutely. And so I was able to go, oh, I'm going to do this. This is what is happening. But then also I've had found just a marked change in my personality. In the sense that I wasn't getting uptight and I wasn't getting aggressive, and the outbursts lessened and lessened and lessened and lessened to the point that they don't happen anymore. You know, it really calmed me right down.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Which...
Was that gratifying?
Yeah. Like it was... Like
relief?
It was kind of just like, oh... Just even when he said that to me, that... you are showing symptoms of ADHD. I was just like, I know. Like, I kind of have known this for so long, and I think my mum and dad have known this forever, and I've just been so...
So why had you never suggested this to someone while you were going through this process?
Because I think that as an adult, it's...
Is it
feel
more
like
shame
because
it's a kids thing?
Yeah, it's linked to kids, you know? It's like, I thought that I would outgrow this shit, you know? So... it's a sense of I'm immature.
Yeah.
You know, why didn't I grow up?
Yeah.
What happened? So you always just think, ah, oh, I'll get better, you know. But I wasn't. I was
depression. That's an adult's disease.
There you go. And I had, but all of those things, like the depression and the burnout, and those are all things that are linked to having ADHD and high functioning ADHD people. A lot of people just see, you know, there is this thing, it's like the ADHD iceberg, and they show what's on the exterior, what people can see, which is just sort of this impulsive behavior or fidgety, can't sit still and all that. But beneath that surface is all of this other stuff, this self-loathing and this anxiety, and you can get hyper-focused on some things, or you can't, you know, finish projects, angry outbursts and... poor relationships with people. All of those sorts of things are affected by it.
Well, it's hard to have a symmetry with someone unless they're on the same, you know.
Well, you just become a bit of a burden,
which
I was very aware of, you know, and I think I'm still kind of carrying around and trying to deal with and come to terms with. But it was to me, I feel like, the best thing that I've ever done in my life. was to get sorted out.
Recognizing that that's what it was and then working from that position.
Yeah. And again, I think mum and dad didn't really want to put me on any medication too, because it was a bit of a, it was very new back then, you know, and dad just thought, I don't want to put my kid on any medication, even though that's what I do for a living.
Yeah.
And so I, last year I sent my dad the ADHD iceberg, and he just writes back, oh, this sounds like me.
Oh, it sounds like your dad or you.
Him.
Yeah, right.
And I just was like, you think, mate?
Yeah.
You think, you spectrum weirdo? Because he's always been on that level. And we were sort of having a bit of a chat about it because my dad is high functioning.
Did you send that iceberg in context? Or
I sent it to like, what do you reckon of this? This is I
making reference to you or him?
Me.
Yeah,
but
right.
in my, but I was doing it to sort of show him, because mum and I had spoken about it, and my sister and I had sort of spoken about it as well. There's something going on with dad. And he's the same. Again, mum and I were talking about this today, that he is one of those people still to this day where he can't get projects finished. He has multiple projects on the go.
Did you post him a couple of your Ritalin?
I should really.
Well, I mean,
hey, give it a go, Dad. You might be all right. Yeah. My dad, he's a great example of some weird stuff that my dad does. Like mum wanted him to do a part of the garden and he was obsessed. He got obsessed with just wanting to make the perfect soil.
Mm.
And so he sifted all of the sand in that whole garden and got all of the rocks out of the garden, and then didn't want to get rid of all of the rocks or pay to get rid of the rocks. So what he decided to do was he would fill plastic bags with all of the little rocks that he found. And then he had them dotted around the backyard on the lawn for months so that it killed the lawn, and the lawn was polka dotted with like this dead spots. And he would then every day go down the shops and then go past some bin and chuck it in a bin down the street. And that is just such a, we were like, what is going on with you, Rain Man? Why are you doing this sort of stuff? But he,
what is the heuristic of deciding that that's the way you're going to do
it? He's just like, this is a good option. And so I'm going to stay doing this.
He's like, I'm retired. I've got the time. This is how I'm going to do it.
Totally. But he is, things that he gets interested in, he really does focus on. And I might not have seen him for months, and we'll be around the table, all of us chatting, and then dad will be chatting, and then all of a sudden dad's not chatting, and you look over and he's just nose deep in a book.
Yeah.
And we always just thought, oh, he's just a nerd.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I'm like, no, that's just dad's that kind of personality. He will just disappear and go and find something that he's interested in and does these sorts of things. And so, yeah, it was really kind of interesting that he just wrote back, yeah, I think that's me.
Now, how do you feel about the fact that you've recognized this of yourself, you know, and you've been diagnosed? you certainly see it in your dad as well, and he says it in himself.
Mm.
This has happened to you at a time when you are raising two very young boys.
Yeah.
Are you just super thankful of the fact that this has all happened now rather than in 10 years' time or in 20 years' time?
My diagnosis?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think I'm glad that my sobriety is still intact, and that I am capable of being present for them and mindful. And yeah, I know that I found dad really, I was scared of dad for a very long time because of his outbursts.
Is it because you didn't understand him? You just couldn't?
I didn't know. Yeah. And he didn't know that he had it or still has it, you know. And he was one of those, it was the same as me.
Yeah.
It was the outburst.
Yeah.
And I was told, oh, you're so much like your father. And I thought, oh, well, I've just inherited his personality because we're around each other so much, you know. It's manifested itself in me as well. And so I was like, oh, well, I just won't be around dad and I'll just work on my own personality. But it turns out that has a lot to do with the ADHD. But yeah, dad was one of those people who just explode at you. And so you just, my dad's got a very big voice and that was really scary. And I, you know, I was like, yeah, I am glad that I have worked this out now from a very young age, because the last thing that I would ever want my children to be is scared of me.
Yeah, of course.
Or to see me drunk. But I do notice one of them now is sort of showing signs of it, because it is genetically passed down. The other one's kind of fine. And I'm kind of, you know, I'm a bit scared of that. But it's good now that I have the awareness of it to know just how to navigate it, I guess, you know. I do see him sort of drift off, and he has said stuff. He's just like, you know, I'm trying, Dad. Sometimes it just gets really noisy here, you know, because he just sort of disappears and doesn't hear you talking, like doesn't hear you saying, can you get your clothes on?
Yeah, and you'd be like, mate, I've been talking to you. And
yeah, where'd you go?
So what's I guess, you know, the great thing there is that, you know, you can come from this compassionate place where you're kind of like, yeah, I do get it.
Yeah.
You know, like I do know what that feels like.
I still yell at him every now and then. Don't get me wrong.
Well, you have the primary effects, but then at least you won't have the secondary or tertiary effects.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like you'll have the blow up about, look, I have to get somewhere and you have to put your fucking clothes on. Exactly. But then afterwards you won't be like, what a shit kid. You'll be like, oh, it's a bit of a shit dad.
Yeah, I know. You're not a bad kid.
Yeah.
And I say that to him. I said it to him this morning, you know. You're a good kid, man.
Yeah.
You're a good kid. Don't worry about it. It's all right.
When you realized that you had issues with ADHD and you started taking Ritalin, did that mean that you had a different relationship with your alcoholism? Because you were like, oh, these two things are probably related, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it did. It made a lot of sense to me what I was doing. I was trying to self-medicate. I was just trying to quieten the mind, just trying to stop thinking or stop feeling nervous or fidgety. I couldn't keep my legs still. Even as an adult, I remember visiting friends or just pretending my leg is just going. And I remember hanging out with my friend Heidi once and she just went, stop.
Yeah.
And put her hand on my leg. It's like, it's okay. What's wrong? I'm like, nothing. Like I didn't even notice it was going.
Just vibrating.
Just, like, just keeping the engine running. Yeah, you know, idle the whole time. And and I think even just with experimentation with drugs, you know, very early on in my teens, I was, I was smoking pot and that seemed to work until it didn't. Mm. And that turned into, just made it a little bit worse actually, where it gave me a huge... just a lot of anxiety at the back end. So that's when I quit. I quit pot very early on, like at 18, because it was giving me panic attacks. And then just found that it was alcohol from then on that was the thing that I could just... It just nullified everything. It's just gone.
Just making social situations more bearable as well.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, you're like talking to someone, you're bouncing off the walls, you're sober. You're kind of like, oh, fuck, this is going to be so much easier if I've just had a few drinks and
chilled out a bit. I'd get really anxious in social situations, like really anxious. And I didn't know why, you know, because people always sort of thought that I was this gregarious individual that was quite extroverted. But that was, I always felt like I was a bit more of an introverted extrovert. And the extrovert part was the person trying to protect the introvert. And you become very good at pretending.
Yeah.
You become very good at imitating other people. You become very good at knowing how to bloody get by.
Filling the empty space as well. Yeah, like you find yourself going, who is this idiot? Like you hear yourself talking at a party and you'd be like, what the fuck am I talking about?
I don't even like cricket. Why am I quoting cricket stats? I don't give a shit about this stuff. It's my boring game of the world.
Mark Waugh was my favourite batsman.
Who gives a fuck? I'm more concerned about what the universe is expanding into, for fuck's sake. You know, it's that sort of problems. But I found that it was alcohol that was the thing that I always went back to, you know. Yeah. And like I said, I mean, in my early 20s, and I mean, I would never say no to drugs when they were around, if they were around, or
but it wasn't something that was needed. The alcohol was what was needed.
Yeah, I never like. I mean, I went through a really big phase, you know, with like MDMA, I think, and that was a wonderful experience. But even when I experimented with things like speed or anything like that, particularly with speed, that I just went, I feel pretty normal.
Yeah, you know,
and that's when I started thinking, perhaps maybe I do have ADHD if we're supposed to be taking this other medication. But I just thought, I don't know, that's all right. That's just not my drug. I'll do this thing instead. But every time if I ever quit, if I ever had a rest on any drugs or anything like that, I was more than happy to just fall in the loving arms of
booze.
Because it just was numb.
Yeah.
You know, but it would help me. I definitely binged and when I was out because of awkwardness. Yeah, I always felt like it would bring out a better personality, which more often than not, it didn't.
To a point.
It didn't really soften the impulsive behaviour in any way.
No, like, booze is not well known for softening impulsive behaviour.
Yeah, yeah. I remember being at your place on a New Year's Eve, and I know I'd stopped drinking for about 3 months prior.
Yeah.
And then we went to your place when you were living in Bondi, and you had that massive balcony.
Mm.
And I started drinking, and it was just like a switch came on, and we were out on the balcony, and I did this. I threw a beer bottle off the balcony, and just it smashed on the road like down there. And I thought it would be really funny.
Killed some random backpacker. I remember that night as well, actually, because I think that there were a lot of people that you didn't know that were there as well.
Yeah.
Which was probably a contributing factor. There was sort of like another group of friends.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you were life of the party. You were also, it wasn't a room full of comedians. It was a room full of other people. And it's like, oh, okay, come on. You're the comedian.
What do you got?
The funniest guy.
You're
funny? Let's go.
Yeah, I will. Let's go.
I also vividly remember I was telling someone the other
punching
day.
Punching me in the nuts when we got photographed. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I remember that.
Speaking of impulsive behaviour,
exactly.
Ben.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's a reason I'm asking questions so I don't have to answer them.
Yeah.
But I remember when we were in Melbourne and we were at Revolver. Do you remember this?
No, Revolver was like a vortex for me. I lost many hours in there.
This was
were we together?
Late stage Revolver. Yeah. I was there with
this is what I said to the bouncer.
Volleyball.
Yes, girls, yes. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
But it makes sense because it was, you know, you sort of, it was like this socially awkward situation because the guy was like, I'm not letting you in. You know, like we went up to the bouncer and we're like, oh, can we go in? And he goes, oh, no, this band's playing tonight.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he'd said it because what he actually meant was, I don't want you to come in.
Yeah.
I don't think you guys are in a state where you should come in.
I was pretty drunk by then. Yeah.
I actually won't say what happened, but I was very amused by that, and that's why
we have to finish this now. We have to.
Well, you said, yeah, we're here to listen to the bands.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he said, oh, really, are you? What bands are playing? And then you said.
I can't remember the name of the band now.
Your Mother Stinky Cunt, are they playing?
That's right.
And I was there going, oh, okay, well, let's go. We'll go somewhere else.
I thought it was You're a Filthy Cunt. No. Oh, I went with your mum. Oh, get me out of here.
Are they playing? They're playing tonight, right? Also,
I'll be very surprised.
Which is the reason why I remember that. Cut. Yeah, well, yeah. It probably will because I can't be bothered editing. That was like 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember that because, you know, you tell the story once every 4 years or something because it's funny to you. And then it's only later on in life where you're kind of like, oh, why'd I do that?
Yeah. And also, how did I not get my head kicked in more than I did? Because I did. You know, I did. And I've woken up in a gutter because of being an idiot.
I remember that night at a Porto's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a month,
that was very scary
a month
time
out
for you.
From my wedding.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I came out of a Porto with burger and chips in hand and these guys started mouthing off and I did the stupid thing of... I remember saying something like, go fuck yourself, da, 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 and this guy came up right up nose to nose, you know.
Yeah.
And I all I needed to do was turn around and walk 1 meter back in the shop and eat my dinner.
Yeah.
They weren't going to do anything to me in there, surely, right?
Yeah.
What I did instead was I just all of a sudden thought I was in a movie and I threw the burger and chips up in the air, got about 4 punches into this guy's head and then woke up.
Yeah.
In the gutter with a black eye.
Yeah.
And it could have been a lot worse. I mean, there was like 8 of them, you know. I know I got kicked around a little bit and my mate got kicked around too.
You also have no idea how you fall as well, you know, in a situation like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's scary stuff.
It was really scary stuff. And I mean, that should have happened a lot because it was my mouth really did run away from me a lot of the time, you know. And again, I think that's sort of linked to that behavior when you're a kid too, you know. You just go, well, to survive this, how do I get through school? I'll just become the mouth.
Yeah.
You know, if, you know, you're a short kid and you're not doing very well or whatever, you just sort of become that. It's funny, you know, just
it's
doing comedies.
It's this ego-driven thing as well. Yeah, you're kind of like, you know, who am I? I can't just be the guy who just, you know, averts your eyes and, you know, walks away from conflict. So who am I going to be?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. It was, I think at that stage too, I mean, I'd had a lot of tequila that night and I know that I was in a pretty dark place personally. I was probably very anxious about the wedding coming up and just all manner of different things, you know, job related or whatever. Just I think I kind of wanted it. Like I think I was sort of sourcing. I wanted to be hit. I wanted to feel something. I don't know why. that was the case, it is just a bit destructive. There were certain times when I was a bit destructive like that, when I sourced those sorts of things out, you know. But I mean, there's like, even with my alcohol abuse, there was things. I went up to the snow with my brother-in-law and a couple of his mates, and we went on a snowboarding trip in my late 20s, and there was a door leading out from our room in the hostel, and one night we went out drinking. We had the time of our lives. It was like karaoke, brought the house down, singing Robbie Williams' Angels, got free rounds of shots from the bar, whole place is carrying us out there like bloody heroes. Yeah. You know, it was one of those nights. It was just an epic, epic evening. So much fun.
Directed by Todd Phillips.
And I wake up outside in my boxer shorts in the snow with hypothermia.
Mm.
That's all. You know, I'm just thinking, how did I get out of here? What the fuck am I doing here? I don't know the PIN code to get in. What's going on? Like, I felt like I was in a dream. I was just trapped in this nightmare.
Mm.
And I was banging on this door, and I ended up having to smash a window to get in. And as I was crawling through, I cut my knee open, which I then the next day had to get stitches for. And the chalet, the guy who ran the hostel, said to me, when I was mortified. I was so embarrassed. I was like, I'm so sorry. My God, I've just obviously sleptwalked. You know, this is ridiculous. So, you know, I'll pay for the window. Can we please stay here again? You know, but he just said, oh, don't worry about it. It happens all the time.
Mm.
It's high altitude. The heaters are on. People walk around a lot. And so I just thought, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. No worries. Also turns out that when I walked out of that door, I turned right, and that led me around to the front door where the pin door, you know, the door was to let me in. Had I turned left, I would have fallen off a cliff and died.
Mm.
And there was no knowing. I wasn't awake. You know, I just could have wandered off the cliff. And again, there was should have been me going, oh, maybe I should stop doing this. Maybe I should stop drinking. That night, night after, we went out again, drank just as heavily. Yep. I sleptwalked around the whole place again. And my brother-in-law had to sort of push me away from doors as I was getting out, then put me back into bed, barricaded the door that led outside again, and made sure that I was safe. And yeah, off we go again. Copy, paste, repeat. It's ridiculous.
You must have found, though, when you've been in the program for a while now, and you're attentive to it, right? You've been
going to meetings? I am not in the program anymore. I kind of went through it to a point where I felt like I'd gotten everything that I could from it.
Yep.
And I worked very hard at that part of it, getting through the steps, and then just thought, I think I got what I needed here.
Which is great.
Yeah.
But having worked with people who, you know, who spend a lot of time in the program, you can't stop until you stop. You know, like rock bottom is so different for lots of other people. But
how far is it?
If it's not time to do it,
yeah.
It's not time to do it. It's so weird that thing.
Yeah, you can just keep dropping.
You can't artificially create a situation where the person's like, do you see how dangerous that was for you? And you go, I should definitely chill out with a couple of drinks after that, because I'm a bit hype after that. You know, it's just not how it works. It's not how addiction works.
No, it's not.
The last thing that I did want to talk to you about was your work. And it's almost a cliche, but being fearful of your work of your work being affected because you are on medication, or you've taken something out of your personality which has been disruptive or something like that.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually end up working that way, but that fear is always there. Was that fear there for you?
Yeah, definitely. When I stopped drinking, I thought I wasn't going to be funny anymore.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, for the first couple of weeks, I wasn't not funny, but I certainly did feel...
Do you think it was actually different, or you just saw yourself differently?
No, I just felt like I was kind of sweating in my jocks a little bit. But then I found, oh, God, I got so much more clarity up here. I'm not slurring, you know, and I started getting quite empowered by that, and knowing that I didn't need that beer or shot or line or whatever to get me through this. It wasn't what nerves did I have? What was it that was really? It wasn't like it had gotten to a point where every night I was so nervous I needed to drink to get onto stage. It was more, I really liked the idea that when I rocked up at certain venues, they gave me my own six pack.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's really cool. Look at me, I've made it. You know. So once I sort of got over that initial hurdle, it was actually really empowering to just be up there on fire, having a really good time and being completely sober.
Yeah.
It's better now. I think I'm better on the fly now on my feet when I'm just on stage, just talking, you know, roasting someone or just doing crowd work, having a bit of a chat, just going from here to there or everywhere. But I think sometimes even there's sometimes when I'm writing where I'm wondering, is this as good as what it was back then? Have I changed? What's changed in me? What do I find funny? Like there's some stuff that I wrote a few years ago that I was sober for that is some of the best stuff that I think I've ever written from that show that I did called Get Rich or Die Crying, that I think I was just like, man, how did you even write that? You know, you were, that was really early on to you being on the Ritalin no, I wasn't even on the Ritalin then. That's the thing. Mm. Yeah. And I thought, how did you get there? So now even when I'm writing, I'm kind of, I don't know if it's made me a funnier writer or not yet. I'm still trying to work that out, but I think it's definitely made me a more present performer who's able to sort of, you know, think very quickly on his feet.
But there's noticeable detraction since you've been taking Ritalin or since you've sobered up. There hasn't been, you know, this this impasse where you're like, fuck, I've got writer's block or anything like that.
Oh, I mean, I think we all had that. It was called 2020.
Yeah,
but right. You know, we just sat around and tried to finish Pornhub. But I've just had a gap year. But no, it's not like
it's hard to do Zoom gigs.
You get paid more.
Yeah.
I think there's been certain things where I can sit down and go, right, I really want to focus on this, or I'll go for a walk and start blocking things out. And I think my memory's far stronger now too, so that if I come up with a new idea, I can just get up and flick it out and just go for it, rather than, I got to look at my notes. I'm sweating. Where did this bit go? You know, you're sort of a little bit all over the place, and you think the alcohol's not is going to help, and it doesn't. It just makes things a lot more muddier. And then you just blag your way through with showmanship. So yeah, I think that's definitely helped me. Yeah.
So with the Ritalin, is this is it something that you want to do, that you get off the Ritalin at some point?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I haven't really had that conversation with my doctor at this stage because I mean, you can, I guess, you know, like I said, I have to check in with him every quarter. He's like, how are you going? Like, what's this going? Blah, blah, blah.
You haven't talked to him about this long-term plan?
I was anticipating that the next time I speak to him, which is in the next couple of weeks, that I was going to ask just sort of, how long do you do this for?
It's like forever.
I don't know if you have to. I know that when kids sort of take it from a young age, they don't have to take it all the way through to their, when they're grown up. So I wondered, well, all right, how old was I when I took it versus how old would I have been when I was a kid? Like you found an 8-year-old with symptoms, so you started medicating that 8-year-old and up until what? They were 18, so is that 10 years? So do I do 10 years now and then just go clean and whatever? But at the moment, it's working for me and I really like it. But, I mean, on the flip side of that, my dad is never going to go in. He's never going to take it. He's just found his way to be a high-functioning person. So, and that's his thing. That's
which is the difference between 70 and 44.
Yeah, I know. You know. Yeah, totally. Yeah. So I don't know. I guess I have to ask him and see as well. But
but things are good now.
They are good now, and I don't want to stop.
Yeah.
I don't see the need for it. It's not like it's doing the opposite effect. It's certainly I'm not hearing a voice telling me to kill myself, which is awesome. You know, and
it's a good starting point.
It's a great starting point. One foot in front of the other. Yeah.
Cam, you look great. You seem great. And you're in it.
I'm in it. Here we are.
Thanks for that.
Thanks, mate.
That was a very lucid and thoughtful Cam Knight. I really appreciate Cam coming in and being so honest on the show. It was great to chat to him. And if you do want to go and see one of his shows, which I highly recommend, Cam is he's an electrifying live performer. You should go to his Instagram, which is instagram.com/IamCamKnight, IamCamKnight. Or you can go to his website, which is camknight.com.au, and there you'll find out about his latest gigs.
That's it for the show this week. We've got another show coming up in a few days' time for Anzac Day. But until then, follow your bliss.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.